Hello and welcome to the Autosport Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Kalanorkas. Today, Formula One went racing at Mugello for the first time, and the action was wild, to say the least. Mercedes took its third 1-2 of the season, with Lewis Hamilton ahead of Valtteri Bottas, but that doesn't even come close to telling the story of a race that was in fact red flagged twice, and featured three standing grid starts. At first, pole sitter Hamilton was slow away. Bottas powered into the lead while Max Verstappen launched nearly past Hamilton before his Red Bull suddenly lost power and he dropped back. And in fact, he dropped back so far he got entangled in a shunt triggered by Pierre Gasly, Kimi Raikkonen and Romain Grosjean getting together at turn two, which put Verstappen out and led to an immediate safety car with Carlos Sainz Jr. spinning in the pack at the head of the crash after contact with Lance Stroll. At the restart, Bottas didn't accelerate until he reached the start-finish line, and as he did so, the pack behind erupted in chaos with Nicholas Latifi, Kevin Magnussen, Giovinazzi and Sainz eliminated in a frightening accident opposite the pits. That brought out red flag one and led to a long delay. At the second start, with the two Mercedes put onto mediums, Hamilton's brakes were fully on fire, but this didn't stop him shooting off the line and stealing first back around the outside of turn one, San Donato. There followed 34 laps of normal racing, with Bottas generally adrift of Hamilton before losing a heap of time before his only green flag stop on lap 31 of 59 as he suffered severe vibrations on his medium tyres. Mercedes called Hamilton in too shortly afterwards, saying it had had to stop Bottas for safety reasons, and he looked in command up front until the race was halted again. Racing Point's Lance Stroll had taken third after the second start from Charles Leclerc, who had held on for nine laps before going backwards from P3 in a series of simple passes as he struggled for power and grip in his Ferrari. Stroll came under pressure from Renault's Daniel Ricciardo, who then undercut the Racing Point with an early stop, but his race came to an abrupt end shortly afterwards and a shocking one too when he crashed heavily at Arrabbiata 2 following a suspected puncture. And after another lengthy stint of the drivers being out of their cars and roaming around the pit lane, there was a third standing start. This time Hamilton had no dramas and he roared clear at the start of a 13-lap dash to the flag. But Bottas was slow away and Ricciardo jumped ahead off the line, although the Mercedes was quickly back to second on the following tour. The second red flag had eased mounting tensions at Mercedes about tyres, and Hamilton and Bottas exchanged fastest laps over the remaining tours, where Bottas never looked like mounting an attack, and Hamilton came home to take his 90th F1 win with the fastest lap to boot. Third place went to a delighted Albon, who lost positions at the final start but battled back to deprive Ricciardo of his first Renault podium, which in turn gave Albon his first F1 rostrum visit. He claimed the position with another bold around the outside pass, but this time it came off. Sergio Perez was fifth ahead of Lando Norris, Daniel Kvyat and Leclerc, who finished behind Raikkonen on the road but was elevated by the Alfa's penalty for crossing the entry to the pit lane too late when the safety car was called for Stroll's crash. Sebastian Vettel held off George Russell, who took the final start in ninth and had looked to have Vettel rather in his pocket before dropping back when the lights went out, and Vettel ended up 10th ahead of the Williams. We're back from the track and at our Airbnb near Borgo San Lorenzo to discuss all of that on Zoom are Autosport's F1 reporter and GP Racing executive editor, Stuart Codling. Now, Luke, I'm going to come to you first. Are you pleased that I asked you to write your first Autosport.com race report for that particular race?
Delighted. You messaged me this morning and said, oh, let's change up the workflow a little bit. Maybe you give the race report a go. And I thought, sure, like, what's the worst that can happen? I mean, I've not written an F1 race report since November, I want to say. So I thought I might be a little bit rusty. Like, hopefully it's a very smooth, very easy race. And then that happened. And I think it was when we had the first red flag that you messaged me going, I'm really sorry about this, like of all the races to pick. And yeah, it was a crazy race, dramatic. A very, very interesting one that you kind of like, you don't want to pre-write too early. And I think I was just starting to think, right, I think we got the result pretty much set. And then we had Lance Stroll's crash and another red flag and everything was turned on its head over again. But yeah, got there in the end, filed it fairly quickly. So I was quite happy with it for a first attempt back. And really interesting to try and, encapsulate what a dramatic race and a really exciting one once again, just with so much going on and so much to pack in to a race report. So thank you for that, Alex. It was a good opportunity, if a little stressful at times.
Excellent. Well, I'm glad you saw it as a good learning opportunity. I actually thought I was going to give you quite a dull race because I didn't expect there to be any overtaking. And I think when we look into the race, there wasn't all that much. There were just some cars out of position that got overtaken going in the wrong direction. I think that was the majority of overtaking in that race. So interesting to see how it played out. But yeah, I was also curious to see how I would be following things when I didn't have a website report to compose. And actually, I did exactly the same thing as I've done for all the other races this year, which is take notes for basically every lap. So it was a very familiar race for me there in terms of the way I did that. Stuart Codling, how was everything in the Lord Heseltine Theatre?
Well, it was quite dramatic, wasn't it? I seem to spend an awful lot of time committing acts of piracy by rewinding and recording stuff and sending you video snippets so we could try and decode various things that went on in the race. It was one of those races where I suppose in terms of race reportage, it's very hard to write a report about a race like that and string together a narrative, because it was basically a series of things that happened. And there wasn't really a backing narrative because it kept stopping. So you had a race that seemed to be carrying on, and then it had to stop, and then it restarted again, and then boomf, that was bunk. And then we ended up with this 13 lap sprint to the end, where actually, you know, tactically there was no strategy to it. There was very little strategically to chew over in this Grand Prix, because by the final restart, everyone was on the, you know, sets of tires that they'd probably used about 8 times before.
Well, fortunately, I have found a narrative to go for my Autosport magazine and Autosport.com Plus race report, which we'll get to later, and involves Valtteri Bottas and how he couldn't look after his medium tyres. But before we do that, John, coming to you, we had a rather lovely view of all the action, particularly the various starts, because there were so many in this race, because the Mugello Media Centre was basically right on top of the pit lane. We were effectively sat on top of the Alfa Romeo pit stops, which was, we discussed this at dinner last night. We were like, oh, we're going to see some pit stops in action. I'm sure it'll go very smoothly, but usually very quickly. Then we remembered it was Alfa Romeo and there was bound to be some chaos, and there was, when Kimi Raikkonen was left up on his jacks at one point, which is rather amusing. We had a very good view of all the action.
Press room here is quite unique, really. You are often above the pits, but normally it's second floor or third floor. You're looking quite far down, and you can't see the detail, whereas because Mugello is not a kind of new world F1 track, multi-billion dollar government show-off project. It's just an old school, fantastic racetrack.
As I said, there were three grid starts. Let's talk about the first one, Cotters, because as you said, you were very helpfully being a pirate. And I don't think you're doing anything particularly outrageous, because we weren't publishing it. We were just having a nice, you know, nice genial conversations, perhaps reviewing the various commentary and bits and pieces that were coming in from the channel that you were watching it on back home. But yes, the start, it was very interesting being able to see it have such a good view at Mugello. Because Luke was on the .com race report, I was able to stand up and look out the window, basically, to see what was going on at the start. And I was absolutely convinced. I mean, the window was literally next to my desk. I could have sat down. It's just there was a great big metal bar, which is where the window opened and shut them, and you couldn't just have a nice little sit down and watch the start. But anyway, I digress. I was absolutely convinced, Cotters, that Lewis Hamilton, when he made his really poor start at the very beginning, moved before the lights went out. It just looked like he twitched. There was a fraction of a reaction as Valtteri Bottas. It happened to him in Hungary. Obviously, it happened again in Spain. And then Monza was a similar thing, although not quite as dramatic. And then we looked at it and we thought, maybe not. And obviously, nothing was said or done. There were no investigation or anything. But then I've had a chance to look at the onboards from Hamilton's car at the start. And he does. There is the slightest of movement. It's actually a nice, helpful bit on his tyres. Don't quite know what it is, but it moves forwards. And then as he goes around the lap, he's told that there was perhaps a problem with the clutch or this clutch system on the Mercedes car, and that he did everything right. But anyway, something interesting going on there. But nevertheless, it looked like that could have been a race losing mistake there. He said that he reacted badly, wheel spin as well, let Bottas get by and into the lead. But obviously all of that came to naught, because there was the immediate crash at turn two, where Pierre Gasly went from hero to even further zero after his qualifying misery, knocked out in Q1. So yeah, Cotters, how did you see that initial start and crash?
Yeah, it didn't really pan out as we'd expected, had it? Because I recall me sending you a message saying, I'll rewind and get back to you on the Hamilton thing after the restart. And then we spent an awful lot of time trying to decode the restart. But yeah, the video you sent to me from out the window, it looked like there was a bit of a movement. And then after the chaos of the restart has subsided, I got an in-car from Verstappen's start, where we kind of thought we generally ascertained that he'd moved, but not exactly forward. It was more of a sort of a transverse twitch, which was very peculiar, because in any car or motorbike that has a sequential gearbox, when you bang it into gear, there is a forward motion and a clunk, but you wouldn't be putting it into gear at that point. So it must have been some sort of thing going through the car while he's lifting the clutch. I imagine that they you know, we've looked in detail at these various team starting procedures in the past and how they have the clutch actuation is done to enable the driver to engage it sympathetically to avoid wheel spin. Obviously, Bottas has reported these mysterious problems that we've slightly poo-pooed in the past, but maybe there is something in the way the Mercedes clutch system is set up that has let this sort of... it's almost like a poltergeist jump in, hasn't it? So that was interesting. And then further around that first lap, you have Gasly. I would say, obviously, the stewards decided not to throw the book at anyone. But when you hear Romain Grosjean's reaction, and obviously, you know, he is ridiculously theatrical at these points, and you can usually guarantee an expletive laden. Yeah, exactly. There's a certain element of theatre and overreaction. You have to say that anyone who's even Formula One drivers who might not have raced there before, if you've raced at Mugello in Forza, you know that corner narrows down, and those two cars that Pierre Gasly was spearing his car between were only ever going to converge. So my take on it was a little bit of red mist on his part. He put his car in danger, and he initiated that shunt. And if you try and drive between two cars, you're relying on the people on the guy on your left and the guy on your right not to squeeze you and have seen you. And if one of them hasn't seen you, as Grosjean said, you know, he came out of nowhere, then they're going to squeeze you inadvertently, not deliberately, just because they've got their eyes full of what's happening ahead of them. And they're not expecting someone to post themselves in between them. So to my mind, Pierre slightly overcooked it there. You can understand why he would have done, but it was a little bit too early. I think he thought that this is a race that's going to pan down to the first lap, and this is a hard track on which to overtake. So I need to get this done now. And so that is his mitigation in my mind.
And just to throw a little bit more mitigation into the fray before we come on to talk about probably the biggest talking point of the race, which was the safety car restart ahead of the first red flag. It's actually Raikkonen gets a little bit of oversteer as he's coming out of as he's coming towards turn two, because the pack is so congested at that point, and it's that little slight right hand down motion that sends him ever so fractionally slightly back towards Gasly, and then, as you say, God, as the whole thing triggers off and ends up with Max Verstappen out of the race. And then yes, the safety car restart. Luke, why don't you talk us through what happened there?
Oh, yeah. Where to begin? Well, so we had the... obviously, the field came around after the wreckage had been cleared at turn two. And the control line, which is where they are allowed to go back to green and start overtaking again, that was quite a long way up the straight. Obviously, it's a very, very long straight at Mugello. So, therefore, it was quite close to the start-finish line. And that meant that, basically, Valtteri Bottas, as the race leader, could slow the pack as much as he wanted all the way to that line. So we had quite a strange situation where he was kind of like coming onto the main straight. And normally we kind of see drivers like pinning it out the final corner, really trying to bolt the restart and get a jump on the cars behind. And he was sort of like passing pit entry, still sort of weaving and trying to get heat into his tires and everything like that. But all well within the rules. And then just as he accelerated and started to lead the field away, we then had absolute carnage behind. So we had four drivers caught up in the collision. Antonio Giovinazzi, Carlos Sainz Jr., Nicholas Latifi, and Kevin Magnussen, all of whom were eliminated on the spot. And it was really just a situation where you had some drivers who were sort of slowing and braking because the cars in front not going quickly enough, and then others behind who were trying to sort of pin it and, I guess, get a slingshot on the cars ahead and get that jump. And it just led to a massive, massive crash that ultimately results in a red flag because all the debris thrown across the track. And I think that was the only sensible action. But I think has become a real talking point after the race as well, because a lot of drivers have questioned why an accident like that was allowed to happen. They questioned the rules, the decision makers. Lewis Hamilton said that ultimately it was down to the FIA to sort of set the rules and not make it so that the safety car lights are going out so late. And he said that ultimately F1 is sort of pulling entertainment even before safety. And that was something that FIA race director Michael Massey was, he said he found quite offensive. He wasn't happy with that remark at all, said that the FIA would never put safety in doubt. And yeah, it was, I think, just a really big talking point. And I think none of the drivers were happy with what happened. Sebastian Vettel said he thought it was quite erratic on the restart. And to me, it just seemed that it was just way too late, like way too far up the straight for them to be going back to green. But we see the same thing in Baku. I mean, that's another track where you've got this massive, massive straight leading all the way to the start-finish line. And that means that the control line where they can get back to green is so far up. Like, so they can just go ridiculously slowly and then have this massive straight. Everyone's going really wide and they've all got to get back up to speed. So it's really just a bit of a recipe for carnage. And that's exactly what unfolded.
Indeed, it was interesting. It was interesting to hear Romain Grosjean, God, as you referred to, the another radio delight from Grosjean, where he was absolutely convinced that it was the leaders and Valtteri Bottas who was to blame for what happened. The FIA completely clears Bottas, said he did nothing wrong, follow the regulations at all times. And there was also another good snippet from Michael Massey where he said, well, the F3 drivers managed to do the same safety car restart with any incident like this. So sort of said, you know, we've got 20 of the world's best drivers out there, and you know, they can't do what the F3 drivers are doing, is what he seemed to be suggesting, which is rather amusing. But yeah, John, what did you make of the FIA's response, and you know, how did this whole sort of situation come to pass, really?
I think the fact that Massey spoke to the drivers on Friday was quite important, because we don't really know what goes on in the driver's briefing. You get little snippets. So, you know, there was perhaps a little concern that, you know, maybe this is a scenario the FIA should have thought of, that there's always going to be a risk of this happening because of the nature of the track, like we've seen in Baku in the past. But Massey said the drivers were warned exactly about the potential for this scenario. They all knew where the control line was. They knew what the tactics were. They had seen, you know, the Formula 3 race this morning, so probably pretty much well aware of how the best way to the restarts were planning out. I think the back end of the grid just got it wrong. I think they were too eager. Probably it was probably magnified by the fact we hadn't had a racing lap up to that point. They'd had one corner. So I think they're all probably quite eager to get going, eager to gain as many positions as possible, because there was this fear that the race wouldn't have much overtaking. So this was the one big opportunity that they hadn't had before. And I think if you watch Nicholas Latifi's onboard footage, for example, this wasn't a problem that just happened on the start finish straight. He nearly hit Grosjean at the final corner. I mean, really, really close.
I think it was Magnussen.
Oh, Magnussen, sorry. He nearly hit Magnussen at the final corner, avoided that. Coming down the straight, the pair of them are quite close. And then, all chaos breaks loose, basically. I think drivers just leaving gaps, accelerating, braking. The classic concertina accident you can see on motorways sometimes when, you know, a car sticks up, brakes suddenly, and it shuffles back, and suddenly the sixth car on the queue has no room to stop. So, but what accidents like that do is kind of make you appreciate kind of the speed that these cars can accelerate and brake. It's only when things go wrong, speed with which Sainz rammed into the back of Giovinazzi, and Giovinazzi ran to the back of the train of cars. Phenomenal. I mean, no one could have reacted to when they suddenly realised that these cars were slowing. It was incredible.
Indeed. I mean, all of the drivers involved, and actually not even just the one sort of involved in the crash, there were several others. I think Sergio Perez, Daniel Kvyat, 12 in total, get official warnings basically for that incident. Cotters, what did you make of it? Do you disagree? Do you think there's anybody who particularly should have copped a penalty for that?
No, I agree with, to some extent, there's a little bit of a, it wasn't our fault going on from the FIA there, but when you look at that accident in detail, it's very hard to actually forensically unpick any one person being at fault, because there's an awful lot of people just doing things and reacting to one another that it's very, very hard to unpick. So, you know, but I did send you about umpteen different videos from onboards as we tried to unpick it during that red flag. And it was tricky. And, you know, my first thought was that maybe Latifi was slightly to blame for it, because he had gone to the left. He was accelerating quite hard and was going to the left of Magnussen when Magnussen checked up. And so my first thought was that people had possibly been behind had been triggered by Latifi going, and they'd followed him and then being caught out by Magnussen slowing, obviously in reaction to the cars ahead. But these are all just sort of individual stitches in a tapestry of a bigger shunt. And an awful lot of people, as Johnny said, it's like one of these motorway things. Johnny and I live sort of in the same part of the world. We see this all the time, junction 4A of the M3, as someone dives into the turn-off lane for Farnham and stamps on the brakes to slot themselves in traffic. The person behind spots that, slams on the brakes. The person behind them has that reaction time built in, so they're a bit slower, they brake harder. Six cars later, someone runs into the back of one another because the reaction time and the velocity is such that there's much less space to maneuver. So when you have Formula One cars who are that much quicker to accelerate, that much quicker to slow down, I don't think you can decode an accident. So it's probably the FIA have done the right thing in just giving everyone a warning, because they were all speeding up and slowing down. And the very wording of the regulations is something that's it's a subjective judgment you have to make on it, because what is the wording of the regulations, that excessive speeding up or slowing down or something like that? Who is the person who sits in judgment on that? It's not the drivers themselves that says, well, I'm excessively speeding up and slowing down. And I put it to Esteban Ocon in his post-race press conference. I said, well, what do you think about that? It must be very hard for you as a driver to judge whether you're speeding up and slowing down excessively when everyone else around you is pretty much doing the same thing. He said, well, you know, as a driver, you would much prefer to have a much firmer guideline of what to do in this scenario. And he, like Johnny, cited Baku as a very similar scenario of a long straight with the go line sort of quite a long way down it, and drivers naturally are jockeying for position as they go towards it. So I think it goes with the territory in a circuit like this.
I can read you the wording of that rule, because I was looking it up before we started this podcast, and it says, drivers must proceed at a pace which involves no erratic acceleration or braking, nor any other maneuver which is likely to endanger other drivers or impede the restart. In terms of impeding the restart, it was actually a very good restart for Valtteri Bottas. I thought he absolutely dropped Lewis Hamilton when it came to the actual acceleration. Then obviously that was all came to naught. They all came into the pit lane. And eventually we got a second grid start for the second race in a row, because that rule has been in for quite a while. We'll do a grid start before after a red flag situation. But we've only saw it at Monza for the first time last weekend. Anyway, the second start, Lewis Hamilton's brakes completely on fire. He said he saw one flame shoot up from his vantage point in the cockpit. Well, as we were watching and videoing, me again, just as I could go back over the start later on, the second start, that flames were properly licking out of the side of his right front, and the steam and the smoke coming off them was tremendous. So he said that the reason why that happened, because I asked him about this in the press conference, was that he had a brake temperature separation of about 200 degrees between the front wheels on the effectively the second formation lap. So he tried to even that up. And in doing so, he sent the brake temperatures above 1,000 degrees, or sent them to 1,000 degrees, at which point, obviously, there'd likely to be a fire. He tried to cool it down in the final corner, but by the time he got to the grid, there was just too much temperature. And I think he was quite fortunate from his point of view. The start was quite quick. I think that's why he said, I saw the flame, I was worried, but eventually the lights went out quite quickly and we got away. And he pulled off this fantastic move around the outside of Valtteri Bottas at turn one. Luke, what did you make of Bottas at that restart? Because it was having been brilliant up until that point, this is where it really started to go wrong for him.
Yeah, it was. And I think it's really been the story of Bottas' season. Like, it's sort of all the building blocks are in place and things are looking promising. And even through this weekend, he was quickest in all three practice sessions, quickest in Q1. And then in Q2, the tables turned and Hamilton was faster and then just about beaten to pole. But then you see Bottas fight back, as you said, make that great start to get the lead, and then drops him really well on the first restart. And then it all was just undone. And I think that we saw a lot of drivers doing this move around the outside of turn one, because obviously that then gives you the inside line for turn two, which gets you the position ultimately. And it was just another, we've seen it so many times this season with Valtteri Bottas making these poor starts and struggling off the line. We saw it on the third grid start as well later on in the race when he lost position to Daniel Daniel Ricciardo, as I'm sure we'll get onto. But yeah, this one again was just like he'd done all the hard work to get ahead of Lewis Hamilton, to be in front on a track where we knew it was going to be difficult to overtake. And then it's just one poor start and it's all undone. And it just really, I think, must be so disappointing and frustrating for him to know that he'd done everything right up to that point. And obviously, you're never planning for a red flag in your head, really, you know, because I mean, once you've done your initial getaway, you kind of think, well, that's it. I don't need to worry about another start. And then it came back to bite him, and a very, very difficult, I think, difficult situation. And I think that was ultimately where the race was lost. And that's how it was won for Lewis Hamilton.
I mean, I think it was more the move at turn one than the start that cost Bottas here. What did you make of Bottas's defense, Codders, when it came to that turn one pass?
It felt like he'd lost it before he even got there, didn't it? I sort of struggled to decode the initial acceleration. It looked like he got away perfectly fine, and Lewis sort of tucked into his slipstream, as if you might do in Sochi, as we'll see in a couple of weeks' time, and then just pulled off around the outside. And I replayed the start. There's a little bit of a dip in the track there, and Valtteri's car sort of kicked up what was probably a bit of cement dust or something, or his plank ground out, and there's a whiff of dust, and it seemed to be around that point where he seemed to lose a little bit of impetus. It's around that point where there's a slight left-hand kink in the straight before it straightens up again, and he just seemed to lose a little bit of momentum there, and Lewis kind of sailed past him quite easily. It was very, very weird.
It was interesting, John. We were talking because obviously we've been in Italy for quite a while now, obviously being at the Italian Grand Prix beforehand, that you know, it's not actually a straight, is it, here at Mugello? It's rather a meandering path down to turn one, as I think how you put it.
This is one of the things you really find hard to appreciate until you're out walking the track or running the track. I ran the track on Friday night, and you always had the belief that, you know, Mugello looked fairly flat start, finish straight, and then it kind of dropped down into turn one with a slight left. But actually, that climb up along the pit lane is quite steep. It's as steep as some decent hills on other Formula 1 tracks. So you're climbing up, and then it drops down. And the first corner has got quite a bit of camber in it. And I think a lot of the drivers over the weekend realised that actually the best way to overtake wasn't to go down the inside. It was to go around the outside. So very few drivers actually tried to force their rivals to go on the inside when they went down there. I just wonder if it may actually have been a better defensive move to try and squeeze someone down the inside and not leave them enough room.
Let's come on to that narrative that I mentioned earlier in terms of the race being lost for Bottas. Obviously, he's behind Hamilton, but he has the opportunity to attack him back, but he just can't. Hamilton's able to marshal the gap. Bottas is never really in DRS range. In fact, I don't think he is at all at this point. And he runs out of tyres on the mediums. You know, he's saying, you know, that Mercedes effectively say they pit him for safety reasons because his right front was down to zero. There was just no tread, no rubber left. Whereas Hamilton was insistent that he still could have gone longer. But what was really interesting from a news or you know, a juicy bit of something point of view was Bottas's radio message where he demanded at his stop to be given the opposite tyre to Hamilton. So, Codis, what did you make of that? Was this again a bit a sign of Bottas trying to do something devious, or was it desperation, or was it just sensible logic that he saw it as the only way he could win this race?
Initially, the way I read it was that he wanted to be given an opportunity to race Lewis, and logically, given that you're against the best driver in the world, if you're on the same strategy as him, it's pretty tricky. So he just wanted to have an alternate strategy to try and do something different. So it was a little bit of a move of desperation. I didn't see anything devious behind it. And then when, you know, the various parties of the first part said that his tyres were shot, you sort of saw it as, well, probably that's what had to happen. What then mystified me was when Lewis was told he had to come in as well, and he said, no, my tyres are fine. And they said to him, this is a safety matter, and, you know, and the undercut's powerful around here, so, you know, in you come. And then he took on the same tyres, which was quite amusing, and and quite unusual. But it, I suppose, you know, if you're for Mercedes, you are in a tricky and invidious position in that you can't be seen to favour either driver. So you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Well, it was interesting in the stint after that, before the Stroll accident and the second red flag, was that Mercedes told both its drivers, although I only really broadcast the messages to Lewis Hamilton, telling him telling them both to stay off the curbs for safety reasons because they were worried about the tyres, particularly after they analysed the tyres that had come off Bottas's car in that first stint. I was quite amused by Hamilton coming straight back and saying, "Well, what curbs?" And Mercedes come back and say, "Well, basically all of them, but the high load curbs, really." Yeah, what did you make of that, John? Was it another example of Mercedes struggling with a combination of a high energy track, high load corners, and hot temperatures, or was it debris? Because that's what sort of Toto Wolff talked about afterwards when it came to the Stroll accident. What do you think Mercedes were concerned about?
I think they just managing a race and minimising the risk of any trouble. They've got such a good car that, you know, when you're in the front controlling the pace, comfortably ahead of everybody, because no other team was really quick enough to challenge them. Max was out early. The battle behind with Stroll, Ricciardo, Albon was so far adrift, they weren't really under threat. So, you know, their only way of tripping up here and getting it wrong was defeating themselves. So, and Mercedes often, you know, have to manage this fine balancing line of managing the battle between the two drivers, but making sure that battle doesn't scupper the team. So, that's why today was quite interesting to see what would have happened with the strategy, because it's rare to allow one of the drivers to opt for a different strategy. It doesn't happen very often. It's something Mercedes don't like doing, because ultimately one strategy will prove better than the other and the driver that loses will be upset and think there's some favouritism going on. So it would have been interesting how that panned out. And it would have been interesting to probe Toto Wolff a bit tonight, but unfortunately, red flag delays, team bosses shooting off early. He spoke for 2 or 3 minutes with a handful of questions on some unrelated topics. So unfortunately, no real opportunity to find what their answer was. You know, whether there are some new rules of engagement, have things open up a bit now that Lewis has got such a big lead that there will be a bit more of a battle? Or has Bottas decided that actually the difference between Lewis and me of less than 1/10 in qualifying and this bit of edge in the race is something I can't take him on. I can't beat him in an equal car on the same strategy. From now on, I need to be doing something different.
You understand what he's saying there, but it's not a good place to be when he needs to be hitting back at Hamilton at every opportunity. He can't, you know, he feel like, you know, it's a matter of time, fine, but it's still not, it's just not good, is it, from Bottas?
No, it's not. No, I mean, it's a matter of time, like, but when? Like, it should have been at Monza. It should have been when Lewis Hamilton had a race-destroying penalty and Bottas in the fastest car on the grid should have been there to pick up the pieces, capitalize, and win the race, but he didn't. Here, it should have been that when you seize the lead at the start of the race on a track where it's very difficult to follow, very difficult to overtake, that you should therefore seal the deal and see it home. And again, he didn't. And it's just, there's just so many times this season where, again, all the sort of, as I said earlier, the building blocks and the foundations are in place. And he was really good this weekend, really strong. He was so much quicker in practice on Friday that Lewis Hamilton really had to go away and like forensically go through all his data and work out where he was losing so much time to his teammate. And to put Lewis Hamilton, who is arguably the greatest of all time, in that position, I mean, that's a massive credit to Bottas. Like, he's really doing well to be. And I think there's a stat that in the last three of the last four qualifying sessions, he's been within a tenth of Lewis in that final Q3 fight. So he's really, really close, but not just that little bit behind. So he can't actually get ahead and get pole. And I just don't know when things are going to turn around now, because we've seen this points gap open up and open up and open up to the point where we're, 55 points now at the front. And I just don't see where it's going to change. And for as much as he may say, oh, well, it's a matter of time, like, things are going to come my way. But when? Like, surely until you do something differently, surely until you're being maybe a little bit more aggressive, maybe, yeah, could have been more aggressive at that restart to hold the position or whatever, then things aren't going to change, because I just don't see, as well as he's performing right now, if it's not enough to beat Lewis Hamilton now, then when is it ever going to be?
Indeed. Well, Cotter's, someone whose things did fall his way was Alexander Albon, although he made a fair few things happen. He lost places at that third start. Sort of seemed to be implying that, you know, things were just bad for Red Bull on the start front all day. But he finally came off. He gets ahead of Daniel Ricciardo, tries the around the outside path, around the outside pass that had gone so badly for him in Brazil and Austria against Lewis Hamilton. But this time it paid off. He was he said something quite pointed on the radio, said thanks for sticking with me. Sadly wasn't asked about it in the press conference. There wasn't enough time for some reason. So yeah, what did you make of Albon's drive today?
It was interesting. It was a game of several halves, wasn't it? Terrible restart. And how much of that was him, how much of it was the car, is difficult to unpick from where we're sitting. The Red Bull is clearly a very difficult car to drive. And I think he's been a little bit unfairly treated in that people think that kind of he's doing something wrong or that he's not up to the task. And Verstappen's doing a lot better job than him. And the one truth of that is that Verstappen is doing a better job than him because he's a once-in-a-generation talent. But what Verstappen's doing is taking a car that's very difficult to drive and squeezing results out of it that it doesn't necessarily warrant. And what did we see today? That the car letting Verstappen down right from the start. So he ceased to become a factor. All we can judge from the Red Bull performance today is that that car seems to come alive when it's on lighter tanks. And given it seems just very inconsistent, doesn't it? There were times when Alex Albon's times were no great shakes, but then given a different set of tyres, all of a sudden the car comes alive. And especially when it's running on light tanks, it seems to be an awful lot easier to drive and imbues the driver with so much more confidence. And it was at that point that he was really coming at the cars ahead and, credit to him, made the overtake stick. And there were other drivers who in that position might not have done that. You know, I'm looking at you, Valtteri Bottas, for instance. Also Lance Stroll, who yes, made indeed. Very heavy weather of certain overtaking manoeuvres earlier in the race. But, yeah, you know, I'll let you have the reins back, Alex, before we start ranting about Lance.
No. You were already quite damning in your assessment of him and our WhatsApp messages during the race, Goddess. John, what did you make of a driver who was pretty faultless in this race, although he can't get a perfect score in my drive ratings because of his qualifying performance? That's Daniel Ricciardo. Had he nailed his, had he done his Q2 time in Q3, he would have been fifth and ahead of Charles Leclerc. So not a faultless weekend for Daniel Ricciardo, but he was brilliant in the race. What did you make of his performance? And how fortunate should Cyril Abitbol feel that he doesn't have to get a tattoo after Ricciardo didn't get a podium?
Yeah, you sense it's coming. It's not very far away now. I did find it amusing that when Daniel was running, even in fourth place early on, the first Twitter gifs of tattoos were appearing everywhere. So I think that's going to be a running theme. And if I was Cyril now, I wouldn't be convinced I'm not going to end this season without a tattoo. So, yeah, another good weekend for Daniel and Renault. They had a bit of a shocker in Monza. They'd gone there full of confidence that they were going to be brilliant there and that podium was coming. It didn't happen. The balance wasn't there on super low downforce. The McLaren was much more comfortable. And these are the performance swings we're seeing, basically, that it's between Racing Point, Renault, McLaren for that head of the midfield pack. The Renault seems to have made a step but suffered at Monza, and they've capitalised on what we saw at Spa. And Daniel was faultless in the race. I mean, just a great, great performance, and ultimately just lost out to Albon, who was in a quicker car. I mean, the Red Bull is quicker than the Renault. There's no doubt about that. He did well. He was running at second at one point. And if he'd had a tyre benefit or a little bit of luck, you know, he could have been well in the mix. But I think he'd be pretty happy with fourth place, more points for the constructors. And I think he'll still be trying to finalise exactly what tattoo Cyril's going to get.
Indeed. Cotters, Ferrari's 1,000th F1 World Championship race celebration this weekend. It's still quite a tough race for them. Charles Leclerc running in third would have been delighted, the few fans that were allowed in under the COVID restrictions. But as you say, once Lance Stroll had stopped making heavy weather of getting past him, everybody else seemed to just breeze past him in an instant. Obviously, his tyres were going off by that point, which would have helped. But yeah, it wasn't a good advert for Ferrari, that performance. And then Vettel in qualifying was poor. Vettel got dropped by George Russell for a large point in that portion of that race. Russell was simply driving away from him. So it was okay from Ferrari compared to what we saw at Spa and Monza, but it was still wasn't great.
Yeah, I don't suppose Enzo Ferrari, if he was still with us today, would be pleased at the idea of this race sort of not being an absolute catastrophe. And yeah, like you say, those opening laps when Charles was just behind the Mercedes, you know, you would think, okay, well, you know, a Ferrari in P3, that's not such a terrible thing, is it? And then you look at the times and he's a second a lap slower, and you think, well, this isn't going to last, is it? And it only lasted because, you know, Lance made particularly heavy weather of getting past him, but eventually he did. And then eventually, you know, the momentum happened and he went backwards. And I suppose, you know, it's tricky times to be driving a Ferrari at the moment. And there are those of us who dispute whether it's even Ferrari's 1,000th Grand Prix. It's involved a little bit of fudging. It involves you having to count Peter Whitehead's privateer Ferrari in the 1950 French Grand Prix, from which Ferrari withdrew because their car wasn't quick enough, I should point out. Bit being counted as a works entry. So yes, it's one fudge after another, you might say, this Grand Prix. Perhaps they might go away and think, actually, we probably shouldn't have been making such a big thing of our 1,000th, that's our 999th Grand Prix as a works entity.
Oh, Cotters, you would have loved it here this weekend. There was I assume they showed it on the world feed, but there was a sort of dancing flag display, which also seemed to feature some DJ music towards the end. I don't know if they overlapped or there were two separate things, but anyway, I thought it was pure pageantry.
Oh, it was awesome. It was only missing Kate Bush and a smoke machine with all that interpretive dance. I was loving it.
Of course you were. One of the most interesting things about at the end of the race, because obviously the battle for the lead wasn't really up to much. Albon, by the time he got past Ricciardo, was pretty safe in third. Was George Russell trying to charge to get a point because he finished 11th on the road, but Kimi Räikkönen picked up a 5-second time penalty because he cut across the pit lane entry, effectively ran over the painted part there ahead of the pit lane. But when Lance Stroll crashed and the safety car was called, Alpha called him in and he jinked in. But that was a clear breach, as we've been reading the race director's note so many times this weekend because of all the checking when it came to the safety car restart. But that's a clear one. They have to stick to the right of the white line at all times, going along that sort of, you know, V-shaped painted part that Räikkönen cut over. But it just led to this really intriguing final few laps as to whether Russell could get within 5 seconds of Räikkönen and get ahead in the end. Only Charles Leclerc got promoted because Räikkönen was able to keep up his pace. Incidentally, he says his car was damaged quite heavily in the start crash. So I have to take him at his word on that. Obviously, Alpha would have been able to work on it during the red flags, but you know, they can't fix everything during that time. But yeah, what did you make of George Russell's drive today, John? Because it was very good at times, but it was also not very good at times in terms of, again, it's a start issue that costs him places, and ultimately that costs him points. And he spoke to him as well. How was he on his Zoom media call?
Gutted, basically. I think he described it as heartbreaking that had this race. He made a poor start in the first race, if we call today three races. Poor start, but great first lap. So had moved himself well up there. As things played out, it stayed out of trouble in the melee, chaotic safety car restart. Managed to get away okay on the second start, not great. But as the race panned out, running in ninth, fairly comfortable actually. Had Sebastian Vettel behind him. Had Charles Leclerc behind him. They weren't closing in on him. Had a bit of a strategy advantage. And then it was that second red flag that screwed him, really, because he'd pitted for tyres when the red flag came out. And Leclerc got a free pit stop, so he moved Leclerc up ahead of him. And then at the start, he made a poor getaway. The team don't know why. The data says it was fine, should have been fine, but for some reason wasn't very good. That it was compounded by the fact that in the red flag, Kimi Räikkönen and Romain Grosjean had been lapped, so had to get them shuffle themselves back round to the back of the field. So went out and did an extra lap, which warmed their tyres up. So when they came round to do the proper start, they'd had an extra lap to get some heat in their tyres, which was perfect for the start. So George was left stuck at the back behind these two cars. He managed to get through, get up to 11th, But unfortunately, not enough pace to catch Vettel at that phase of the race. And really, really, really upset because, I mean, Williams has been through quite a upheaval in the last few weeks with Claire leaving and Frank stepping away. I think he just felt that effort could have been rewarded today with some points. And on a day when a lot of cars crashed out, perfect opportunity. So, you know, he's really pretty upset tonight, actually.
Indeed. I think Sebastian Vettel had some quite nice words for him after the race. Interesting race for Russell. Let's leave it at that because we must come on to what is going to be our final topic tonight. And I'm going to throw each of you the same question. We'll start with Luke, then we'll go to Codders and end with John. And I shall, of course, have the final judgment from the host. Now, this is something that the drivers have been asked about all weekend. Valtteri Bottas was very clear in the press conference. He wants Mugello on the calendar every year. So, should Mugello be a Formula One track every season, Luke?
Yes, absolutely. I've loved it this weekend, honestly. I think as I touched on the Friday podcast with Jake, like I'd not watched a lot of racing at Mugello in the past. I think my experience, much like Codders, was based mainly on Forza Motorsport on the Xbox. But no, it's been amazing. I think it's been really, really cool. It's been a real nice, I think, reminder of what these kind of sort of old school circuits can be like. Sebastian Vettel was asked after the race today about the sort of the camber corners and how much of a role that plays. And he was like, well, you can tell it's not a track made by Herman Tilke because you have got all these camber corners and there's nothing off camber and it's really fun to drive. And I just think that's really cool. And I liked it that we had in the event notes that you mentioned on Friday, I believe there was an update and the track limits. And normally every Thursday, we always get through the event notes and we normally do a story saying what the track limits are going to be for the weekend. And it'll be some draconian rule about how many times they can go over such a part of the curb or whatever. And this weekend, all it read was the track limit is defined by the start of the gravel, and that's it. And that is how every track really should be. I think that really gave the drivers a good challenge this weekend. I think it was amazing to see them pushing so much. I don't think they ever went below third gear on a hot lap in qualifying. Obviously, they were going flat for a big, big portion of the lap. And I just think that's mega. And I think it's a really cool track. I'm very envious of you guys being there because it seems like such a cool place to be. And yeah, I'm absolutely game for this being on the calendar every single year if there's a good case that it can be secured long term.
But just before we come to Codders, for your point of view, interesting, another note in the race director's notes, there were several of them issued because there were various updates added. One of them was just to remind the drivers that the safety car was painted red this weekend, which was a nice little tidbit. One of our perhaps more immature colleagues in the media centre found this absolutely hilarious and was guffawing about it, which was just bizarre. Yes, indeed, it was lol. Codders, do you think Mugello should be on the calendar every year?
Can I say a cadenced and nuanced yes to that? Because the heartstrings say yes. Practically, you know, it's never going to happen. There's never going to be the government money to make it happen. If everyone wanted to and needed to get there and all the fans were there, it would be a colossal pain in the ass to get in and out every day. I know it's like that at Monza, so hey-ho. I just kind of think this has been a magnificent and almost, well, unique set of circumstances in that we're at this great track here racing Formula One there for the first time, and a lot of unusual things that wouldn't otherwise have happened have happened. And if it were to become a fixture on the calendar, the amount of data each team would have on it, the way the drivers would approach it would change. And I think it would become one of those circuits where everyone says, you know, there's no overtaking or there's too much DRS or the undercut's too powerful or blah-de-blah. And they would just ruin the memory of what has been a great first Grand Prix here. So I'd just quite like to cherish the memory of what's been a great and exciting Grand Prix weekend and kind of put it on the shelf and polish it every now and then and not let time and cynicism diminish it.
Stuart Codling is the voice of reason. That's a very odd situation. John, what do you think? Should Mugello come back next year?
I'm going to cherry pick the best of Stuart's and Luke's arguments, actually. And I think it's been a great track, great Formula One, and we should come back. However, I agree with Codders that A, the reality is there's no money to pay for it. And B, I agree that when we come back, it won't have the same magic. The teams will have nailed their setups properly. They will have nailed their safety car restarts. They will have nailed their standing starts and the overtaking places and where to block. and what to do. So it will lose a lot of the benefits that we've had. But the solution should be that as the calendar expands, the team should agree to hold one race at a proper old school track each year. It can rotate around. So we can have 1 year at Mugello, we'd have 1 year at Imola. Let's go to, you know, 1 year in Turkey. Let's pick out some old tracks. Let's go
Pescara.
Yes.
Yeah, what about 1 year at 1 year at Brands Hatch, because that's the closest one to my house. Sorry, go on, John.
So we just pick out, just let's have some rotation in the calendar, because I think one of the poor things about Formula One is it gets it repeats itself too much. It's the same venues year after year after year with the same rhythm, which has a benefit of, you know, understanding the vibe of the season, but you do need some new venues chucked in. You do need a bit of variety. It seems to be a bit uncertain. So, you know, let's get our 22 races in that are paying top dollar, and then the teams can sacrifice a bit of extra cash, and we have one proper old school Grand Prix each year.
It's very important to separate the sentiment you have for a particular race from a venue's values and potentials and what generally happens there. Now, this time last year, I wrote a column for autosport.com excoriating Hockenheim for being a complete dump. And
yeah, I believe one of the television commentators was very upset with you.
Oh, dear. He literally bored the arse off me, as he does his viewers. At the coffee machine in the Williams motorhome, telling me that I was an idiot for excoriating Hockenheim because it had been a brilliant race. I said, but name redacted, it was only a brilliant race because of the change in climatic conditions. And I'm afraid that name redacted then came back and said, but you're an idiot because it was a brilliant race. And I said, but name redacted, it was only a brilliant race because of the change in climatic conditions from heat wave to alternating heat wave plus torrential rain. This does not diminish my argument that the venue itself is a dump. What made the race was the cloud formations and the high pressure and low pressure zones around it. And unfortunately, name redacted then, as idiots tend to do, I'm afraid, just endlessly restated his position. So fortunately, he got bored and bogged off, and finally I got my cappuccino while the poor lady in the Williams motorhome said to, well, he was very aerated about that, wasn't he?
I do hope you didn't have that cappuccino in the afternoon, Cotters, because that would be a very big in Italy.
Well, it was initially, my request was put in at about 9 o'clock, but by the time name redacted had finished windbagging, it was about 9:45, so dear Lord, we were almost at lunchtime and my stomach was rumbling.
Fair enough. Well, as I said, I'm going to have the casting vote on this whimsical suggestion of should Mugello come back every year. I think it should, for the very key reason in that, John, you and I went to the track on Wednesday ahead of the event. We wanted to get our bearings, did a little video for motorsport.com, which went on our motorsport.com Instagram channel, and also a video as well. As you were doing that, walking around the car park, I spotted a snake, grass snake, slithering through the grass, and I had the perfect... And it formed in my mind the perfect, you know, biting satire that I was going to post on Twitter with this picture about Formula One and snake pits. And then I made the mistake of going, John, look, a snake. And then it shot away and I lost it. And it was very upsetting. But it wasn't the only snake I saw that weekend. But it would just be nice to have seen it again. I also was a bit concerned I was going slightly mad, but John did see it as well.
It was ridiculous how it... was suddenly there posing for the photograph and then disappeared within the blink of an eye. And I did have to check my feet to make sure it wasn't wrapping itself around my shoes, but it had gone. Luckily, we managed to shake off the snake.
We're going to have to leave it there. It's very late here in Mugello. So thank you very much for the three of you for coming on the podcast tonight, and thanks to everybody listening along. Now, just before we go, we'd like to remind you that the latest issue of Autosport magazine came out on Thursday and is available on the supermarket shelves and in newsagents, as well as on the doormats of subscribers. There'll be a new issue of the magazine for you to pick up every Thursday, packed full of news, analysis, and the usual stunning photography. And of course, if you want unlimited access to Autosport from the comfort of your home, visit autosport.com/plus to find out how to subscribe to our digital package. We'll be back soon with another episode of the Autosport Podcast. Music is 6 AM by Trelo, written by Marcus Simmons. See soundcloud.com/Trelo Music.